ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 29th of October. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Hurricane Melissa has made landfall in Jamaica. It's been described as the storm of the century. It is the most powerful storm on the planet so far this year. It's a Category 5 hurricane, meaning it's likely to cause catastrophic damage with wind gusts of up to 350 kilometres an hour and dangerous storm surges of up to 4 metres. Countries across the Caribbean are under threat. Hundreds of thousands of people have evacuated their homes and at least 7 people are dead so far. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Trees bend in the wind and rain pummels the coastline as Hurricane Melissa makes landfall in Jamaica. The Category 5 hurricane is the strongest direct storm to hit the island in 174 years. Karen Madden is a reporter from the Jamaica Gleaner in St. Catherine in the country's southeast.
The hurricane did make landfall about 2 hours ago in to the west of Jamaica, the western end of Jamaica, Westmoreland, Trelawney, St. James. Those parishes are feeling the brunt, the full force of Hurricane Melissa at Category 5 strength. Where I am, we are not yet at the full brunt, but we are certainly experiencing heavy wind and rain since last night.
She says footage is beginning to emerge of houses submerged in floodwaters and buildings with roofs being torn off.
This is unprecedented. We have never experienced this. I think it's going down as perhaps the strongest hurricanes, or certainly one of the strongest hurricanes to hit a landmass. So that is fueling anxiety. People are concerned. People are trying to reach their loved ones in other parts of the country. The infrastructure is struggling to keep up in terms of communications.
Liz Bentley is a meteorologist with the Royal Meteorological Society in the UK.
So this is the most powerful storm that will have made landfall in Jamaica. It's the most powerful storm that we've seen this year in the hurricane season of 2025.
United States National Hurricane Center Director Michael Brennan says storm surges of up to 4 metres are expected.
Stay indoors. Do not go out when the eye crosses over. There will be a period of relative calm, but with the forward speed increasing and the very small size of the eye, winds will pick up and dangerous conditions will pick up very quickly as the backside of the eye moves through. So do not go outside. Plan to shelter in place throughout the day today.
The storm's expected to slice diagonally across Jamaica before heading north to Cuba. Jens Larkey is a spokesperson from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Everybody is really mobilized to the maximum. If we are indeed looking at the storm of the century, which we are. We are where we need to be at this point. Time will tell how hard it's going to hit Jamaica, how hard it's going to hit Cuba, how hard it's going to hit Bahamas and further down the line.
Hundreds of thousands of people have been evacuated in Cuba, Jamaica and across the Caribbean. Hurricane Melissa has already been blamed for 7 deaths, 3 in Jamaica, 3 in Haiti and 1 in the Dominican Republic. Authorities say around 1.5 million people remain in the path of the storm.
Bridget Fitzgerald and Kimberly Price reporting there. Israeli planes have launched strikes on Gaza City after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused the militant group Hamas of violating a ceasefire in the Palestinian territory and ordered the military to carry out powerful attacks. Hours earlier, the ABC travelled inside the so-called Yellow Line, an area in Gaza under Israeli control as part of this fragile ceasefire. Independent media can't visit Gaza. This trip was supervised by the Israeli military, which decides who enters and when. And until now, the ABC has not been allowed to enter any active or former combat zones, despite repeated requests. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran joined one of the trips to the eastern edge of Gaza City.
Sitting in the back of an army jeep, we're hanging on tight to the railing as we rattle along a road beyond the Gaza fence line. We're not travelling that fast, given the route ahead of us has deep gouges from the tracks of tanks, which have run up and down this road for the last 2 years. The mangled, crumbled mess of buildings start coming into view. At first, they're the remains of small structures, likely agricultural buildings, which stood here before the war. But as we reach the crest of a small hill, it's hard not to gasp at the scene. Stretching far into the distance, the twisted wreckage of a once bustling community. This is what was Shejaia on the eastern edge of Gaza City. To say it's been pummeled fails to adequately describe the devastation. The roads and laneways which once ran between these buildings are almost indistinguishable, with seemingly every building toppled. Until a point, you can see where Israel decided to halt its campaign to take control and occupy Gaza City days before the ceasefire deal was struck, as that's where the buildings are still standing, albeit significantly damaged. Israel's military says this level of destruction was necessary to remove vast tunnel networks stretching to the Israel border and remove booby traps left by Hamas in buildings. But seeing the scale of this gives rise to the obvious criticism that this mission went far beyond clearing out terrorist infrastructure, a criticism I put to the IDF.
A war is a difficult thing. It's a hard thing. This war began because of Hamas and wouldn't end because of Hamas.
Lieutenant Colonel Nadav Shoshani is the Israeli military's international spokesperson.
And the way this war is fought is because of Hamas's actions or Hamas's tactics in this war. We have done everything we can to prevent this war before this war, even to our detriment. And we have done everything we can during this war to make sure that we are allowing civilians to get out of harm's way.
Israel believes some of its hostages remain hidden amongst the rubble here. And the scene before us only serves to support the Palestinian Health Authority's statements that thousands of Gazans are also entombed in the mess of concrete and metal. The military estimates there are a few hundred Hamas fighters still hiding within the more than 50% of Gaza it controls, and up to around 1,000 civilians are there too. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have returned to parts of Gaza City beyond the yellow line in recent weeks as well. The forward base we've been taken to is the same one senior US officials Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner visited in the hours after the ceasefire came into force. This is the part of Gaza which Israel wants the world to see as it tries to justify its relentless campaign over the last 2 years, labelled a genocide by a number of international bodies, including the UN, charges rejected by Israel. While this brief visit, controlled and choreographed by the Israeli military, is no substitute for free and independent access to the Strip by the foreign press, or the work of the brave Palestinian journalists who've been telling this story for the last 2 years, it's still a valuable insight as the world watches what comes next in this conflict. This is Matthew Doran on the outskirts of Gaza City, reporting for AM.
The first member of a group of so-called non-citizens in immigration detention, known as the NZYQ group, has been quietly deported to Nauru. The group was released into the community after the High Court ruled their indefinite detention was illegal. Australia signed a deal with Nauru for the hundreds of other former detainees to eventually also be sent to the Pacific Island. But when they'll be deported and how much the deal will cost Australian taxpayers remains secret. Political reporter Adam Langenberg has the story.
News from Nauru doesn't travel quickly. 5 days ago, the tiny Pacific Islands president announced that the first member of Australia's so-called NZYQ cohort had been deported there. And on Tuesday, reports of the immigration detainees' arrival finally emerged in Australia.
I think Australians are owed some transparency around this.
That's Shadow Home Affairs Minister Jonathan Dunningham. He wants answers to several key questions, including when the bulk of the group will be deported and whether taxpayer money has already been paid to Nauru as part of a deal to take hundreds of immigration detainees from Australia.
The deal itself, it's hard to say whether it's a good one or not because they won't give us the detail.
The NZYQ cohort refers to a group of about 350 former detainees who were released into the community after a High Court ruling found their indefinite detention was unlawful. They're all non-citizens. Most of them have been convicted of crimes or had their visas cancelled on character grounds. Earlier this year, Nauru agreed for the group to be settled there, in a deal the Australian government is happy to spruik.
Until that was there, we had a situation where for some people, no matter what laws they'd broken, cancelling a visa was meaningless.
That's Immigration Minister Tony Burke on Insiders earlier this month. He's refused to release the terms of the 30-year agreement publicly, but department officials have revealed Australia will pay Nauru an initial $408 million after the first deportee arrives. And the deal could end up costing billions of dollars, depending on how many of the cohort end up being sent to Nauru. Greens MP David Shoebridge.
We don't know how much money is being paid to Nauru. We don't know if that's on a per person been deported there.
He says he's incredibly concerned that Nauru is not safe for the people who will be deported there. That's a concern shared by Jana Favero from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre.
I acknowledge that Minister Burke has said that the conditions are excellent in his eyes, but with absolutely no transparency around it, no one to visit, you have to pay $8,000 just to apply for a visa. It's impossible to know exactly what the conditions are.
The ABC has asked Tony Burke a series of questions, including how many of the NZYQ cohort are currently in Australian immigration detention, and whether he is satisfied the people sent to Nauru would be safe. But he declined to provide further details, saying only that when someone's visa is cancelled, they should leave.
Adam Langenberg. The ASEAN summit involving 11 Southeast Asian nations is wrapped up in Malaysia, with the host Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim telling Donald Trump his tariffs are too high. Dr. Anwar is given an exclusive interview with the ABC. He says while the US is a tough negotiator, he can live with trade deals signed with the US president as the region is diversifying its trade ties. Southeast Asia correspondent Tim Swanston reports from Kuala Lumpur.
There's been far more eyes on this year's ASEAN summit than usual, partially because of the attendance of US President Donald Trump on the first day. He dominated headlines, signing trade agreements with Southeast Asian nations and overseeing a peace agreement between Thailand and Cambodia. The man who made this year's ASEAN happen is Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim, who signed a trade deal with the US president, getting exemptions on certain products from Mr. Trump's so-called Liberation Day tariff.
We did our best, and I think I am fortunate because the ASEAN leaders have been very supportive. Of course, the negotiations with the other partners, particularly the United States, were tough, but I think finally it was an amicable sort of a settlement.
Prime Minister Ibrahim spoke to the ABC at the end of the ASEAN summit about Donald Trump, the task of finding a balance between the US and China, regional conflicts, and as someone who has long been outspoken about the treatment of Palestinians, about Gaza. There have been questions raised about the trade deals signed between the US and Southeast Asian nations this week, which seem to particularly favour the US, keeping punitive tariffs in place while those nations make concessions or agree to heavily invest in US goods. Prime Minister Ibrahim says although he expressed that the 19% tariff rate is too high, Mr. Trump is just representing US interests, like he will represent Malaysia's.
I happen to be Malaysian Prime Minister. I will have to protect Malaysian interests. And we make quite clear to him, and in spite of the general perception, he was a good listener.
Along with signing individual deals with the United States, ASEAN collectively signed an upgraded free trade agreement with China this week. China's assertiveness in the South China Sea is of concern to ASEAN members, particularly the Philippines. Mr. Ibrahim says he's received assurances from China's Premier Li Qiang that they're committed to establishing a code of conduct in the South China Sea, something that's been discussed since 2018.
Premier Li Qiang has given that commitment, and in today's deliberations, he made it quite clear that he wants this to be done speedily so that one of the issues can be resolved. Of course, it's more problematic with the Philippines, I concede, and that we'll have to ensure that we navigate this to so that it does not escalate and preserve the peace in the region.
Global leaders, including Mr. Ibrahim and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, will make their way to South Korea on Wednesday as summit season rolls on into the APEC summit. This is Tim Swanston in Kuala Lumpur reporting for AM.
George Orwell's famous novella Animal Farm is familiar to many of us, being a popular high school English text. Now it's being used in a nationwide competition to teach young people about the brave new world of artificial intelligence and to figure out what's real and fake. Hannah Ross compiled this report.
The animals would still assemble on Sunday mornings to salute the flag, sing Beasts of England, and receive their orders for the week, but there would be no more debates.
George Orwell's political fable Animal Farm is 80 years old, but its message on the power of language to manipulate reality is striking a fresh chord with high school students, particularly as they learn about digital literacy in the age of AI. The text is a starting point for a nationwide schools competition called Win the Farm that coincides with Media Literacy Week to teach young people about how AI can manipulate truth and politics.
I think Animal Farm is easy to expose students to a political dichotomy. So it's a good way for us to keep it all relatable, keep it more easy to digest. It's a good way to have some fun visuals, it's animals. It is less about a political statement on what we think the state of the world currently is.
Jessica Zhu is from Day of AI Australia, a philanthropic organisation that works in schools to boost young people's knowledge around AI. She says the competition shows students how AI can undermine reality and truth by encouraging them to create their own social media bots.
2025 was a big election year. So what we saw was 17% of the social media activity were bots that were trying to push some sort of political agenda. So we were trying to get the students to start thinking about how do bots actually impact the social media world? How does it impact what you actually see in political environments and also non-political environments?
Ballina Coast High in northern New South Wales is one of the first schools in regional Australia to take part in the competition.
I'm Kobe Ross and I'm in Year 8. I use AI quite a bit at home, so usually I can tell between AI and stuff in real life. Yeah, I mostly just talk to it. It can be misused, so yeah, I think I'm definitely worried about it. I mean, AI is always going to be around. It could be used to help political leaders and help people like doctors and people who use lots of technology, but we don't want to use it too often because it can lead to problems.
UNICEF Australia's head of digital policy, John Livingston, says its data shows teens are mostly using AI to assist them with homework, but a quarter think this means they are cheating.
I guess young people themselves at the moment aren't sure. They're adopting it quickly. They're putting it to use in their lives for schoolwork and other means. But there isn't that guidance in place that's giving young people a clear message that, you know, this is a sort of safe and responsible way to use AI in your life.
UNICEF's John Livingston, ending that report by Hannah Ross. Illegal vapes are flooding into regional communities in Western Australia. They're coming into the state through post offices and illegal vape shops, despite the state's tough anti-vaping laws. Parents and businesses say they've reported illegal activity to state and federal authorities and nothing's being done. Andrew Chowding reports.
Across Western Australia, communities are at the forefront of a national vaping epidemic. The WA government has boasted the state has some of the toughest anti-vaping laws in the country, but Donine Hawley, who runs the local post office in Kendanup, 350 kilometres south of Perth, says illegal vapes are arriving weekly.
I'm probably getting at least two a week monthly. Yeah, you're looking at least six a month. So there's only one, maybe two that we know of that are the underage. The rest are adults.
And how do you know that these parcels contain vapes?
My son actually had a friend that got one, and so he asked him, was curious and asked him what it was. So the friend opened it in front of him and showed him.
While vapes in small country towns like Kendanup are arriving in the post, 70 kilometres south in the city of Albany, the illicit substances are being sold direct to the public. One store in the CBD marketing itself as a candy store is just 600 metres from a local primary school. People who went into the store told the ABC they were offered vape products from under the counter when they inquired, a convenience store down the road offering ABC reporters the same. One parent, Danica Joystotter, provided the ABC with emails she sent to the Australian Federal Police, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, Border Force and the Department of Health, but the vapes kept coming. WA's Police Commissioner Cole Blanche says enforcement of the ban is a matter for the state's health authorities.
It's a Department of Health enforcement role.
However, WA's Health Minister Meredith Hammett says police support is crucial.
So it does make sense for the two agencies to work together if there are more serious crimes also occurring to make sure that when enforcement activities happen that we're gathering all the evidence, taking all the steps to make sure that we are closing those shops down.
WA Cancer Council's Libby Jardine says people wanting to report illegal vapes don't know where to turn.
So from our research, we can clearly see that people in Western Australia are confused about the current legalities and they want the government to do more to address this situation.
The council is one of 17 WA health organisations urging the government to do more.
And the Cancer Council has published a joint statement and we're calling on the WA government to make further legislative changes.
Meredith Hammett says the government is working on strengthening the laws, but no timeframe for their completion has been set.
Andrew Chowding there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi,
Hi, Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The cost of medical treatments and dental work in Australia can be exorbitant. So, no wonder more and more people are accessing their superannuation funds early to pay for things like IVF and dentist bills. Today, ABC reporter Selena Edmonds on her investigation into how the rules are being exploited. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.